So he spoke, and so he spoke, that Lord of Castamere.
The following is a Mediocre Movie Club production.
Now the rains, we bore his home with no one there to hear. Yes, now
welcome back
rains,
to the Mediocre Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel, and with me tonight is Shane Settner.
Yo!
Sean Riley.
Hello.
And Bobby Schmidt.
Hey.
We are back with our Game of Thrones Greatest Hits series. This week, we're talking about the fourth and the fifth episodes of the third season, entitled And Now His Watch Has Ended and Kiss by Fire. These are two great episodes. I think we nailed it with our picks this week. I picked the fifth episode, and Sean picked the fourth one. Great job. We're doing air high fives, Sean, you and I, because these episodes, again, are fantastic. Kiss by Fire is my favorite episode of the whole series. I look forward to talking about it. But first, we're going to talk about And Now His Watch Has Ended. If you want to start us, Sean, just tell us why you picked this episode.
Well, as I had mentioned last podcast, when you asked me why I picked an episode, it was a 100% Wikipedia episode descriptions, because I don't remember what episode is. I don't remember specifics about episodes, so I just went episode descriptions. There was a lot of significant things happening in multiple areas. I wasn't going to go wrong, and I got it this week.
Yeah, a lot of spectacle in this episode, with the ending wherein Dany lets her dragons loose and she takes Astapor, she kills everybody, all the slavers there, gets the Unsullied. Huge, big scene on par with like the Blackwater stuff from the second season. But this is still early enough in the run where they're not shying away from people in rooms talking to each other. And this, the fourth episode is a showcase for that kind of writing. And, you know, we give Benioff and Weiss a lot of well-deserved shit, but they wrote all these scenes. Most of these are not in the book. And it's, like, consistent between characters how these conversations are going. One character is trying to manipulate another while making it seem as if they are not. They're like digging into their psychology and picking out some kind of weakness and then mirroring that back to them. Ramsay is doing this to Theon. Dany is doing this to Tim Driscoll. Olenna is doing this to Cersei. Margaery's doing it to Joffrey. These characters aren't in the same places, but you can tell that this was all this was all like packaged in one single episode. And that's just something rarer and rarer when you have like series on Netflix that the showrunners feel compelled to be like, this is just a 10-hour movie and not an episode. Like this episode 4 really feels like a concrete package where it's just like thematically consistent. So that's the small stuff, and then the big stuff. Yeah, that final scene with Dany, with the combination of like her domination theme that they bring back over the course of the series, but it's never as powerful as it is right here when they first whip it out. That ending is, I prefer it to like anything as far as like the spectacle of the show thus far. I think it improves on like the big giant green explosion in Blackwater and all the fighting there. Like this just feels really visceral and powerful in a way that like a lot of that stuff did not.
You feel like it's domination. I've always, like, rewatching, I just feel like just a ruthlessness from Dany, and we're just having competing threads between Dany and Cersei this whole time. Who's more ruthless? And that's actually one of the questions I was asked towards the end here. Like, who is more ruthless? Which one of these two characters is more fucking ruthless?
It's hard to say that about Dany just because she's a lot easier to get behind than Cersei at this point. Or ever, really. It's never easy to get behind Cersei, even when she's like getting revenge for her eventual walk of shame.
I was gonna say it wasn't so hard for Jaime.
There we go.
All right, we've got two competing. We talked about the perv viewers in that Blackwater on our previous podcast episode, and now we found a couple of them. So that creepy producer who was whispering in Neil Marshall's ear We know exactly who he was talking to.
I'd like to give Sean an air high five. That's much better than the air high five.
Air high fives going across the airwaves.
Well, I noticed when you and Sean went for the air high five, you start with knuckles, then put your hand out. It was very awkward. Sean and I just wanted a clean one.
All right, fair.
This is a jumping Walter Payton Tecmo Bowl.
Oh, shit, yes.
I don't think the show ever tries to portray Danny, especially here, as cruel or anything like that, or the same as Cersei in any way, especially with her whole "you guys are all free now, you can leave and no one's going to stop you" type thing, is trying to show more of her motherly side and domination.
I'm full agreement with Bobby that it's not ruthlessness, it's tenaciousness. She has a goal, she's willing to do what it takes to accomplish that goal, but in numerous times we also see her as having a heart. Cersei has not shown that. Ruthless is an apt description.
Yeah, and like the show, I think over the course of Dany's arc, reveals that her like single-minded focus, shifting from like getting to Westeros to freeing all the slaves, was bad for her. She's going to spend the next four seasons in Meereen and Astapor and Slaver's Bay. Because she experiences mission creep. Like, this is the culmination of it. Like, all right, now she's freed all these slaves, she's going to continue to free slaves, and she becomes less of a conqueror and more of a liberator, and that's not what she originally set out to be, and she's going to be mired with Dario and the Sons of the Harpy and all that going forward. Whereas Cersei has, you know, more or less been single-minded, even if she's like not as powerful. So as far as what the show thinks is the better way to go, I mean, again, it's easier to be on Dany's side because she's freeing slaves. But where we are in the current state of the show is that Cersei is queen as well, and she didn't have like the gift of three dragons to help her get there.
I just completely disagree with you guys. One, this is a bad contract formed in bad faith. Like, you literally just stole all that shit and you made a big show of it just to steal everything.
Well, no, transaction was completed.
As I understand, I mean, sure, is it current U.S., like Western real world law in Game of Thrones? No, but that is not a good contract.
Tim Driscoll didn't do his due diligence is the problem.
Disagree.
I think dragons may fall under bird law.
So like, this was never a good faith deal. She knew what she's gonna do, and it wasn't to free I don't know if it was to free the slaves as much as to say fuck off to these guys who are treating her like shit. And like, Danny, okay, she has a soft spot for her soldiers just as much as Cersei has a soft spot for her kids and brother. So I don't know, I think at the end of the day, Cersei's more ruthless. Yeah, but only because she's in the position of power right now. I think Dany does the same shit.
So I get two questions. Cersei, as much as she supposedly does anything for her kids and Jaime, she never thinks about what her actions do to them, like the consequences. Because obviously her actions end up being just as ruthless towards them, and all her kids are dead because of because of what she does. And I don't know, I don't think Dany ever goes that far where she doesn't think about her actions. Although I would ask then if the death of Viserion is going to change that.
Well, I think she doesn't really think about her actions in the chaos that ensued from killing all the masters. Like, you go from one political system to just fucking chaos. And that's what happened. Right?
I think we're also probably answering the question on Cersei's ruthlessness based on seeing where the series goes beyond this point. Because up to this point, she is still very much in fearful of her father's opinion and, you know, wanting his support.
That's true. She's not wearing any badass black dresses.
Yeah. No pixie cuts.
Yeah.
I think this is the first one-on-one scene between Cersei and Tywin in this episode, and like, she makes a somewhat pathetic play for his admiration. Like, I'm smarter than you think I am. I'm smarter than both of my brothers, and maybe you should have invested in me with all this power. And then the advice that she gives him is like, the allies that we've paid dearly for and who saved our lives, I think they're going to try and screw us. To which he, you know, like throws her out.
Well, yeah, I don't just trust you because you're a woman. It's because you're not as smart as you think you are.
Yeah, it's such a good fucking line.
And like that is also a show invention, but it builds on the Arya and Tywin stuff that we didn't end up spending any time on from the previous season. But you get a sense of exactly that with Tywin. Like if you can offer some level of talent or at a very minimum, like entertainment to him, like he's interested in how you're going to react to certain things, then he doesn't care if you are man or a woman. He'll give you the time of day. Where and Cersei just has repeatedly demonstrated with her terrible child that she has no idea what she's doing.
Such a good scene between Charles. I mean, I just miss Charles Dance. He's so fantastic. And Lena Headey, they just play off each other so well in that scene. That's the one where it ends. She says, "You do something about him." He says, "I will." And we cut to fucking Lady
Tyrell?
Tyrell. Right? Olenna.
I can't remember exactly. I
couldn't think of her name, but. So that's the scene where it cuts to the Queen of Thorns.
Yeah, that's some nice cinematic language there.
Is he complicit? Is he complicit in Joffrey's eventual?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so, and we'll never find out if so.
Yeah, I don't think it makes much of a difference. It's good. It's better for everybody that Joffrey dies. So I don't think he's upset about it necessarily, but I don't think he had a hand in it either.
That cut right there made me actually think that maybe he did. So I'm looking forward to the books because I think that maybe flesh that out. I don't think it's
they do not. He's definitely not involved in the book.
She's still alive in the books, though.
Oh, you mean like in? Okay, gotcha. Like she might say at some point.
Yeah.
In 2025, when the sixth book gets released. So this is a great episode. Full stop. However, we do revisit Pod the Sex God. With Varys and Roz discussing this particular plot development. Again, we discussed this last time. It just requires so much absurd behavior on the part of characters that we know and characters that we don't know who exist in a world that the show does a generally good job of fleshing out for no reason. For no reason.
Right. Well, at least they established that Littlefinger was too distracted by his upcoming trip to the Vale to realize that his whores didn't pay him.
Which is bullshit. We all know it.
Absolutely. 100%.
Which, if 5 gold were missing or anything. Yeah.
I would imagine that the 3 women who had the vast privilege of getting to spend time with a clumsy, I don't know, 17-year-old kid who's never had sex before, and if their minds are completely blown by it to the point where they refuse payment that is not even his in the first place, they would tell everyone in the brothel and it would get back to Littlefinger. And
I mean, everyone seemed to pretty much know. Like it got passed along pretty quickly, so I don't think Littlefinger is going to miss out on that.
Stupid.
No money. Stupid plot line. This mustache doesn't pay for itself. Is that a good Littlefinger or a bad one?
It's not terrible. So
they could do a better English accent than he does, so that's good. But I guess
you know,
with the fingers. So.
If we can just go back a sentence and realize that I complimented you on an accent,
thank you.
Therefore, encouraging more of this nonsense.
I assumed you did that, so I would stop doing.
I did it because I wanted to
see. Exactly. It was not a compliment as much of a carry on.
Yes. Yes, it was. I am going to regret this indefinitely. I might cut it out, but we know it still happened.
I told you never to trust me.
Son of a bitch. So, can't praise Jack Gleason enough in this greatest hit series. And we see him in this episode essentially showing off his Lego collection or something equally dorky to a girl who is pretending to like him. Where he is like running around the Sept of Baelor telling Marjorie all about how this Targaryen died in a grisly fashion, and this Targaryen died, and this Targaryen died. He's just so excitable. He's got such a beaming look on his face. He's having a great time, and he's not murdering anyone. Like Marjorie's having a great a great impact on Joffrey at this point.
He's not murdering it, he's just talking about the death of the people, his family.
You know, he would be downloading like podcasts of My Favorite Murder, or just of any one of the many true crime, somewhat exploitative podcasts that are just flourishing these days. And Marjorie, to her great credit, we talked about manipulation. Like, she's just doing such a great job pretending to be interested and then complimenting him for all his knowledge. Just that dynamic.
Well, if it weren't for the the townsfolk outside inspiring her to reel that hook in for manipulation, they could have gone any number of additional places for the awful tour to Joffrey. So the power rankings are the upcoming five tour to Joffrey tour stops.
Nice. All right.
They were pretty exciting at the beginning, but Joffrey loses interest. He wasn't planning this tour. So they're gonna go downhill really fast on the tour of Joffrey. Sure. So it's gonna ask a lot of Marjorie to keep engaged.
This is a solid metaphor. Okay.
So number five. So right after we're done looking at Targaryen bodies, we're gonna go straight to the wall and see that Ned's head and all the heads that he has put on the pikes, and he's gonna mock them and point them out, point at the bugs flying. Heads on the wall, always good for a first date. Number four. We're going to go check out the bloodstain on the carpet in Joffrey's bedroom where he shoots horse with crossbows.
I mean, we don't know that he's done that at this point in the series yet.
I'm not very good at that game.
It's not unlikely that that he has some practice. It certainly wouldn't be surprising. It wouldn't raise any eyebrows.
Okay, and Marjorie's so excited here. She's she wants to know what's next, and Joffrey starts to panic. So number three, we go to the kitchen table where Joffrey shows off his boogers under the table collection, where he picks and wipes it.
He's super into body horror. I mean, that qualifies.
Number two, we go back to the bedroom where there is a collection of jizz napkins underneath Joffrey's bed.
Marjorie's interest is waning, and we're getting more shots of her looking at when Joffrey is not looking at her. She's giving some solid transitions from interest face to I'm going to strangle this little monster face.
My lord, I've never seen such a stiff sock.
And then number one, a cat walks by and reminds Joffrey, the piece de resistance, I have a pile of Tommen's dead cats. Sir Pounce Jr., the Dornish cat, Pounce de Leon. Of course, Marjorie loves it. They live happily ever after. Do you think Marjorie could have turned Joffrey into a reasonable human being?
Yes, I absolutely do think that.
No.
He's nothing about her was sincere either.
His frontal lobe never developed. It's just bad.
I think there's no reason to think that Joffrey ever had sex in the period of time that we know him. I think he choked to death a virgin. And I think, in the same way that Marjorie eventually withholds from Tommen, she could have really messed with his head and manipulated even more than she is already manipulating.
I feel like that would have brought out the worst of him, if anything.
Maybe it would have just satiated him in some way. Like, he's not going to be a monogamous king who like the one person in the entire world that doesn't have to be, but.
Right, but if he doesn't die at the wedding, then Tywin gets his way and marries Cersei Dolores, and she's gone.
So
it would be all Marjorie to finish either molding him into her sex slave or use her powers for good. I mean, she doesn't. Yes, she's manipulative, but she's not evil.
And Tywin would also have unfettered access to Joffrey as well. I don't think he.
Olenna no question. And Tywin together.
The guy is fucked up.
Yeah, they're going to completely dominate that.
Quick theme alert on episode four. Theon is, he gets his monologue, his soliloquy to fake Ramsay. Well, real Ramsay, but like Ramsay pretending to be someone else. And he has neither the ability nor the inclination to fulfill his birthright. He's a third son. He's completely trapped as far as what's expected of him, how he's been raised. And just this feudal system is, in his case, going to lead to nothing but misery and death. Whereas if he had the ability to choose his fate in a way that somewhat freed him from the life that he was trapped into, his life would obviously be a whole lot better. And he's at the very top. Like, he is the son of a great lord. So if it sucks for him, how fucking terrible is this world?
With how bad Ramsay's whole storyline ends up, this is such a hard storyline to follow up on a rewatch and care about. I just don't give
a shit.
I
think it is great up until this episode. After this episode. I think the work that he does in this episode and the previous episode goes a very long way to making sure that Theon doesn't try to escape. That totally just like breaks his faith in anyone that could potentially be an ally. I think it's a masterstroke and a believable one on Ramsay's part. Now, do I believe that he is just as skillful at sneaking into Stannis' camp and like sabotaging everything? No, I do not. That's absurd.
Right.
I 100% believe that he is good at manipulating people.
This is just like...
This is appropriate Ramsay talent.
Rewatching after being caught up is just lingering Ramsay overkill.
We're not there yet.
We'll
revisit.
This is when we're all like, this is a good addition to the story.
Yeah, like he hasn't even been named at this point.
Yeah. Before he comes overpowered and just overdone every episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
The peak villain at this point in Game of Thrones is again showing off his Lego collection to his girlfriend. Anything else on this episode before we move on to episode 5?
The Hound and Arya and Dondarrion was a great scene.
Oh, we'll talk more about that.
I figured.
Yeah, it's supposed to be the next scene.
Yeah. It's often hard to tell how much time is passing in Game of Thrones, but in this episode, in that corner of the world, it's going from... there's like a 5-minute break between what's happening. So, the 5th episode of the 3rd season, Kiss by Fire. This is my favorite episode of the whole series. I'll say it again. I cried no less than 4 times during this episode. There is no big action. Not really. There is no grand set beyond just the normal standard Game of Thrones type stuff. I'm not here for the spectacle. I'm here for the characters to see their disappointments, their hopes, so on and so forth. And this episode is lousy with that kind of stuff. The Emmys for this season completely overlooked, based on this episode alone, Nikolaj Coster-Waldau and Maisie Williams. I think Peter Dinklage got nominated for this season, and Emilia Clarke did as well. They're both solid. Peter Dinklage is as good as usual, although I don't think he's as good as he has been in this season. But the way that the Emmys work, in my understanding, is that you submit an episode to the voters, and they watch that episode, and based on that episode, they decide whether or not to nominate you. And then if you're nominated, you send more episodes. If Coster-Waldau and Maisie Williams both sent this episode, it's bonkers to me that they could not have been nominated, because both are giving some of the best performances in the entire series. And all those 4 crying times are based around their scenes.
I would say for Coster-Waldau, the critics and the voters were probably a little distracted from Qyburn cutting the pus out of his wrist.
Okay, I thought you were going to say the back sack. Yes, thank you, Shane.
it's a more succinct
description of what happened.
Going straight from grimacy wrist to back sack is a tough stretch.
Yeah, I remember. I remember that scene because that's when I first saw you crying during this, when we watched together.
I don't think we would have
you
watched
said,
this
said, that's some beautiful back sack.
Look at that filthy man and his balls. I can see them between his legs.
Since we're already talking back sack, do you want to skip ahead to the 5 asses?
Just yeah, spot for, the butt double. This is a fun game for this episode. There are a whole bunch of butts. One of them was not the actor. We see Jon Snow's butt. We see Ygritte's butt. We see Brienne's butt, Jaime Lannister's butt, and the butt of the male prostitute. One of those butts is not real.
Jon Snow.
Anybody else?
I would have guessed Jon Snow.
Well, I'm going with Jamie because A, Backsack included, and B, I think he's a little bit older. Even if you're in shape, when you get old, you know, things start to sag and things start to, you know, wrinkle up a little bit. And that was a nice tight ass.
We played a version of this game in the seventh season, wherein we spent a good 2-3 minutes talking about Jamie's butt in what was obviously a butt double in that case, because for exactly the reason that you're talking about, Riley, like that, the butt in the seventh season that was supposed to be Jamie is a very tanned man. Whereas then you cut to Jamie in bed with Cersei after, and the guy's got like gray in his beard. Doesn't make any sense. The fake butt in this episode belongs to some stunt double for Kit Harington because he fell off a roof or something during the filming of this season, and he had a cast on his leg. It's not that he is averse to showing his butt on screen. I think eventually he does that in the future, but he had a cast on, so they had to bring in the double. But hey, good job. Good job, Bobby and Shane.
Thank you.
You win.
We know our butts.
You win this week's round of Spot the Butt Double. Maybe we'll use it in the future.
Wait to post that on my Instagram.
I mean, it's a big day for you and your family. So, another theme alert. One of Butt Arya's double? Fantastic scenes. Her scene with Gendry. Gendry, of course, doesn't know that he is the bastard son of Robert Baratheon at this point. He thinks he's a lowly orphan from Flea Bottom who just blacksmiths and occasionally gets sold to people. Arya, and he knows who Arya is, and just their positions in the world make their relationship impossible. They can't really be friends. She can't ally himself with her because there's always just going to be this vast gulf of social status. So again, we see the feudal system ruining interpersonal relationships, no matter how strong and potent and real both those actors are conveying those relationships to be in this episode.
So you're saying is on the penultimate episode of this upcoming season, after Gendry has learned that he is the bastard child of Robert and, you know, has some king's blood, and Arya is now of age, that she will then do a similar seductive dance that Ygritte did in the cave and ask if he would like her to be his lady now.
I mean, it's totally possible. I hope not, because Arya, like, I feel thematically needs to have a bad ending. And,
well,
and we also know
he's
that
no
Gendry
Potter
and Hot Pie are going to end up together also. So that would totally throw off that thing, unless there was a devil's triangle at the end of the crossroads.
Right, they're playing a drinking game?
Whatever you got to
lots of ale.
Enjoy yourself. More score praise. The bad idea music from Theon clumsily beheading Sir Roderick in season 2 shows up with Robb beheading Lord Karstark in a really like fast sequence from him killing the two Lannister kids to himself being killed. It happens very quickly. It seems like there is not a lot of time going by for what is a major decision. Holy, like the momentum of it wholly works. Just because you don't have a lot of time to think about the consequences before Robb is just going all the way with it. And the music, the bad idea music, it's bringing you consciously or subconsciously back to that moment when Theon like hit the point of no return in taking Winterfell and killing Sir Roderick.
Just another example.
Well, they didn't give you a whole lot of time just to see the Karstark burst into the room and kill the kids in the first place.
Oh, that beard.
I mean, that just kind of boom is gone. Well, you could tell who it was, but like, who was he killing? Now I know who it is.
If I remember right, I don't think there's a break in that sequence. I think it's killing the kids. They're in the main hall, and then Robb is cutting his head off. I think it's just boom, boom, boom.
Another example of someone fucking up and not listening to women around him. Running theme here.
Yeah.
There's a lot more to it in the book about why he beheads him, though. Like, it's not just because it's on like a inexperienced whim. Like, there's a lot more reason behind it, because he also kills like two guards and a couple other people, not just the two Lannisters. But I don't know. It's a bigger ordeal.
It's taken for granted in the show that Robb has no problem ordering the deaths of the people that helped Karstark. I think that that covers that part of it. He even like gets a super cold, somewhat cool line with the last guy who just watches.
Yeah, you we'll hang you last so that you can watch the other ones hang.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And there's another theme alert tied up with Robb. he talks about how his options are limited. His army is now shrunk by a large amount. And just more in sidebar, but this is like more of the show, just not having the time at this point in the series or any point in the series to really show how the war is like affecting the small folk. Once all these Karstark people are, once they leave the army, it's not that they all walk orderly back up to the north. They just all become pillagers and rapers and tear apart the countryside just as much as like the Mountains Men were doing, or the Bloody Mummers at this point in the book. So they're just adding more chaos to this just because Rob executed this one guy who arguably deserved execution, but here nor there. When Rob is discussing his options with his wife, he says, "We can't go back north. We can't go retake all that, even though it would probably be very easy, just because they so vastly outnumber the Greyjoys, and because the people obviously don't want the Greyjoys there, and it would just be a wholesale revolt, piece of cake. Can't go back north because winter is coming, and if everyone is safe in their beds with their families again, why the fuck would they want to ever go back to war again?" Like, Rob is like a traditional hero, but he is also keeping all of these men away from their families because his family got slighted, and because I don't know, they want to pay less taxes to the crown while paying the same amount of taxes to him. He's the show like never comes out and like points a finger at Rob in any way, really. Like, he's short-sighted at the worst, but again, he is like contributing to the decay of this world as a very bad winter is on the way.
Right, he could have sat back and just chilled. That's it. Said, "Fuck off. We're not paying you king anymore."
Yeah, they could have just barricaded themselves.
Go fuck yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
he has to be too aggressive.
Danny has her mission creep with like freeing the slaves, and Rob has his. Except he doesn't even know what his mission is anymore. He's just in the South now, so fuck it. I guess I'll go take Casterly Rock now.
There is something about being in the South that just makes you want to fucking fight.
One more theme alert with Gendry. And not only Gendry, but with Grey Worm, the introduction of Grey Worm with the Unsullied. You get characters choosing their leaders instead of just following drunks and maniacs and bad dads out of obligation. And just everyone is more satisfied with this. And the show's kind of gotten away from it. Like, people are choosing Dany, but she does have the dragons. It's very colorful. It's
right,
very
I feel like that's just choosing the odds.
Exactly. Yes. It's not like, it's not altruistic on her part that she's being followed necessarily.
It's like,
she says it is, but again, like, you can't just tell Greyjoys we're not going to rape and pillage anymore. And they're just like, okay, I guess we'll do that now.
It's like your friends from the early 90s who are Cowboys fans, and they're also Duke basketball fans, and they're also Bulls fans, right?
Yankees.
Yeah, just Yankees smart fan. Sports fans, it sounds like to me. anything else in episode 3.5?
So the previous episode ended with, you know, Danny leaving the walls, and you see, in the camera pans back, and you get to see her. You know, she now has an army and three dragons, and she's legit. When we see Ser Jorah and Varys talking, you know, they immediately bring back up how Robert had sent out assassins for her and had wanted her dead. And, you know, at the time, he had wanted her dead. She's a child. Well, now Robert's right that he wanted her dead, because now she has an army. She has three dragons. She's a threat. It was just a very good callback at a very good time.
It was just like a wholly selfish impulse on his part. Like, I want to preserve my power and kill this girl that he hasn't. At that point, she certainly didn't. Or he predicted all that. Yeah, you're right. But I think we obviously, even at this point, when Dany is so early in her turn as a ruler, that she's still preferable to Robert, who is just, you know, going into debt and doing nothing but drinking and whoring and just asking for the breastplate stretcher and just generally being totally ineffectual.
Y'all are way higher in Dany than I am.
I mean, she is freeing slaves at this point in her
sure,
run.
I suppose, yeah. Okay. Like, I guess Robert was...
It all depends how the show
Robert
ends.
Robert Baratheon was a step up from the Mad King as well, so...
Sure. And, like if his son had lived, he would have been a step up over all of them, most likely. I don't know. There's lots of different ways it could have gone.
Sure. I'm not super high on Danny. I just like on this in this rewatch as well as reinforced that, because she is. I just feel like she's impulsive and ruthless, and that's it.
I think that the show has made a mistake in not showing her be ruthless towards people we like. Like, yeah, great, she kills a bunch of slavers. And as much as we love Tim Driscoll, I mean, I feel like he had three episodes. That's a solid run on Game of Thrones for a guy who I only know from getting killed in the pilot episode of Deadwood. So good on him, but I feel like it's even too late for that. Like, the only person that is opposing her, who's not the Night King, is going to be Cersei, and she has also run her threat out. So that'll be totally fine if that's how it does indeed go.
This is why this could be a very good show.
they could have muddied it and complicated it.
I feel like it is complicated. I don't think so. I feel like they're subtly making Dany do ruthless shit. And because I'm very smart and you are not, John, I notice it more.
At this point, is the ruthless shit we're talking about is breaking a poison fruit contract.
Listen, I take the law very seriously.
All right.
Even made up law that I don't know or understand. But I feel like it's a bad contract. That's all I'm saying. It's a bad contract.
I feel like if you're entering into business with a guy who just like cuts off the nipples of his trade for fun, as a demonstration, then I don't know how much is a contract of that guy worth in the first place.
It could be worth the nipples on a man. I don't know.
Again, we don't know the rules in this period of time.
What are the rules?
So our next segment, Remember When This Show Was Great. This is the first we've seen of Olenna on this rewatch. Just a great character. Who is also great in the books. And I feel like eventually the show doesn't realize what an asset they have, and they just kind of run out of things for her to do. Like, in the books, you lose track of her also for the entire fourth book, but there is the sense that there's going to be this grand reveal at some point in the future where you realize that she has been pulling the strings for hundreds of pages, and she's just going to enter stage left at some point in the sixth book and like pull her mask off and be like, it was me the whole time. So that's all fine. That's all a holding pattern. But the show should have just like elevated her from guest actress, which Diana Rigg always was, into like the main part of the cast. Like part of producing a television show over a long period of time is that you figure out what works and or what's working and what isn't, and then you accentuate what is, no matter what your original plans are. And when you get a character like Olenna, who is fucking working in every scene with every character that she ever plays against, you got to give her more to do.
Don't you think they realized that they fucked up with Dinklage and Pod in this season, that they didn't want to do that to her?
I mean, I think that the sex god stuff is just general cluelessness on their part. And I thought it was bigger than it was in the previous episode, but I don't think it comes up again. I thought they kept talking about it and Tyrion kept investigating. that wasn't the case in these two episodes.
Well, I think with a character like Olenna Tyrell, it's a risk worth taking. Plus, it's got to be difficult to write a scene that's as bad as something as Tyrion and Pod for her. Like, you just her in a scene and the way she just commands the screen, it's tough to make it bad. Like, you'd have to actively...
She could have spent more time talking about how figs help move her bowels.
And that would have been far better than Tyrion and Pod.
They're not cribbing from book dialogue. Like, as great as the scene with Jaime in the hot tub with Brienne is, like, it's practically verbatim from the books. They just copied and pasted from one to the from the book to the script. Everything with Olenna, like if you like what she's saying, they came up with it. She's not in the books that much, and you only like get a sense of what she's saying when like Tyrion is a point of view character or Sansa is a point of view character, and she has scenes in these two episodes with Varys, with Tywin just yet, with like her handmaids, with whoever else that she's talking to, and So they can do it.
I hope she's one of the characters that George R. R. Martin is talking about when he says he's changed things and made bigger plans for some characters that are still alive in the books and not in the show. Like, hopefully he's smart enough to realize that fans reacted very positively to her in the show and the books.
Yeah. Like, she gets completely neutered once the Faith of the Seven and the Sparrow shows up. They completely fuck that whole part of the world. Like, just somehow these dudes with clubs are able to completely subvert the entire power structure of Westeros.
Clubs. Oh, I got barbed wire on mine. Why do you have barbed wire? You mean horses?
Yeah, they have cloaks and tattoo brands or star brands on their foreheads, and that's better than a suit of armor.
Where are you keeping cattle? It's fucking King's Landing. Where's all this barbed wire coming from? Well, we keep it in to keep the prisoners in. That's where you gotta watch it.
Ugh. Anyways.
I think Olenna is a casualty of two things in the future show. It's as they contract the storyline and it becomes more action dense, like we've said, there's no more time for two people talking in a room. She's never going to be on the battlefield. She's the two people talking in a room character.
Do you think
so? There's that.
Like, filmed a scene.
Put her on a dragon.
Riggs on the green screen, charging into battle.
Right.
Well, and then also, as much as we like that two people in a room, I've subscribed to the notion that most people are dumb, and the majority of fans like tits and dragons. So they shifted the focus more towards the majority.
So you're asking for Diana Riggs to show her tits to a bunch of dragons.
Hey,
is that what
why not
here?
Six butts in an episode
Jesus
instead of five?
Christ.
Well, have you ever seen that Johnny Depp movie, Ninth Gate or something? It's where like him and he's like this investigator, and there's this cult that's trying to open this portal to hell. Well, at the very end, he has sex with this girl, and there's like a dragon on this tarot card, tits and dragons.
Okay.
Yeah, I got nothing on that.
So what you're saying is
Ninth Gate, Johnny Depp.
This is an adaptation of that movie.
You watch that movie in the blurry HBO at your parents' house in 1998, didn't you?
No, I'm going to say 98 might be the right year, but it may have been a little after that.
So, Shane mentioned Littlefinger earlier. This is still a point in the show where they can convincingly sell the threat of Littlefinger, specifically the scene between Olenna and Varys, where Varys does his thing where he just very suddenly drops all of his mannerisms so that, and he did this with Ned in the first season a couple times, just to convey how serious what he's saying is, and he tells Olenna that like Littlefinger is the most dangerous person in the kingdoms. If he gets a name and land and an army, he will be unstoppable. Not what happened in the show. Like, that's the kind of foreshadowing statement that the show is usually pretty good about, as far as like foregrounding that. And he finally gets his army at the end of the fourth season. It should be this huge ominous moment at a point when Joffrey is dead, when they're still figuring out who the next villain is going to be. And then I don't even remember what Littlefinger does in the fifth season. He like gives Sansa up for nothing, and then he fucks back off to the Eyrie.
Sansa
with his giant army. Like it never feels like he's a threat after he throws what's her face at the moon door, Lysa.
Well, I think Littlefinger's obvious miscalculation was trying to get Sansa to fuck him.
Sure.
And you know that didn't work out for him, and it led to his demise.
They ran out of time for my storyline.
Your little finger's getting worse.
Yeah, that was, I don't know what that was.
His accent gets worse as the show goes along.
And the fake Sean Connery on Jeopardy.
His manner Jones manner of speaking is not consistent from season to season.
Sean Shaw, Shakonga Shaw.
Speaking of great underserved villains, Roose Bolton, he gets such a sick burn on Jamie in Harrenhal, and I feel like he almost even cracks a smile during it.
The actor's so
again, great. They just lose track of what they have with these people.
And that actor, so in the, he's another one of the actors who doesn't give a shit about this show, and I think it plays
so respectable.
Well.
It's so respectable when they just talk shit about Game of Thrones out in the world.
It's so great, and he fucking nails it.
I've been distracted by Roose Bolton ever since I listened to the audiobooks, because Roy Dotrice does Roose Bolton's voice in falsetto.
That sounds like a totally fine choice.
I'm not doing that accent.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Sir Jamie is not red.
I can't wait for Sean and I to do an audiobook together now.
I mean, the guy is dead. And 2025, practice, you know, like 100 different slight variations in the same vaguely English voice.
I think I've done at least 10 accents in the show, if not.
I mean, where's Russia in Westeros and or Essos?
You know,
if he dies.
If he dies, he dies. I feel like the Greyjoys could totally have that accent.
I mean, a Shy by the Sea may very well make an appearance in the sixth book. They could be Russian. Why not,
Jans?
All right. So, last...
Isn't that where fake Rachel Weisz is from?
So, last, remember when the show was Grey Point, Beric Dondarrion, who we meet for the first time in these two episodes, he talks about there being a cost to resurrection. You come back a little less every time.
It's not the first time.
Well, all right, fair enough. We saw some rando in the first season. Who is not?
Who doesn't get a line? Just like, yeah, okay, yeah. All right.
He opened his mouth and he had a Roy Dotrice as Roose Bolton falsetto, and it's like, no, this isn't gonna work. This guy's got no gravitas.
I'll get the
recast.
Yes, sir.
Anyways, the recast actor talks about there being a cost to resurrection. And then when John gets brought back, there is no cost. He barely talks about it. It's not a big deal. People around him don't really talk about it. Like, this guy got brought back from the dead. Everyone's more or less fine with it. He's the same person. He learned nothing, and it didn't cost him anything. Whereas, Beric Dondarrion is beat the fuck up. Like, you see all the scars and the damage on his body, to say nothing of his personality and his psyche and how difficult it may or may not be to get brought back to life. John's totally fine. Frustrating.
I don't know if I'd say totally fine, because he's much moodier.
Yes, very angsty.
I feel like he made a few jokes after the fact. He was very happy to see Sansa when they got reunited in the sixth season, post resurrection.
When he gave up Lord Commander, said my watch is over, and then did a belly laugh and it cut like an 80s sitcom. That was pretty good.
He very playfully drew some chalk drawings in a cave in Dragonstone for Danny to get wowed at. Like, we didn't see the montage of him and Davos throwing pieces of chalk back and forth to each other and splashing water and all,
it was,
and just being mess around dudes. But
to be fair, it was only his first resurrection.
I guess.
Beric had like 7 of these to get worse and worse.
I don't feel like there's been any change in how Kit Harington is playing the character at all. And it hasn't been in the show either.
Are you suggesting that maybe, just maybe, that's Kit Harington?
Totally possible.
Being a really good actor?
Another fun commentary bit. When it was the kid actors in episode 2.3 who did the commentary, they complimented John on something very simple for an actor to do, just like moving in the scene. They do that again in this episode. In the fifth episode, Nicholas Coster-Waldau and Gwendolyn Christie, who play Jamie and Brienne, do the commentary in the fifth episode, and they compliment John on his ability to walk. Just from point A to point B in a scene.
Listen.
He's doing it very convincingly. A lot of backhanded compliments.
As
in
someone, to be fair.
Which I find delightful, that there's this running joke within the cast of Game of Thrones that Kit Harington sucks and everybody knows it.
As someone who has run an in-reel program at a school with a theater program and has watched theater kids do modestly athletic movements, it's something. It ain't nothing.
All right. We will give Kit Harington the most minimal of credit for being able to convincingly walk on screen, which I feel like is the bare minimum for an actor who might find himself in the top five on the call sheet for a major drama series on a major network. So how good on you, Kit Harington. Actually, pin that gold star to your chest.
How bad would it distract you if when it came to action scenes he looked so ridiculous?
He's a convincing action star. I mean, and there are many convincing action stars. Keanu Reeves, for example, who when they're moving around, great, totally buy that you're a world-class spy. Yeah. And then they speak, and you want to see them shoot people again without speaking.
Keanu was in which Shakespeare movie was that with Denzel?
Much Ado About Nothing?
Yeah, maybe. He was in a Shakespeare movie with Denzel Washington.
I don't remember anything about him specifically. He also did Bram Stoker's Dracula around that time, in what I feel like is an all-time worse performance. he doesn't really work as a Renaissance.
He can't help it if the script doesn't say whoa. Okay, he's got to deal with what's been given to him.
Gary Oldman as Dracula pops around the corner and Keanu just can't help himself. Francis Ford Coppola off screen is like, Keanu, for the 53rd time, you got to stop saying whoa every time you see him in his costume and his makeup. We are running through so much film. So book changes from these two episodes. We don't have to talk about what we missed because we did a back-to-back pair, but we can still talk about book changes. And this is also mentioned in the commentary that it was wise on the show to not talk about Jamie's half boner when he gets in the hot tub with Brienne, who was also naked. That would have been hard to convey on a television show. We already saw Jamie's balls from beneath his butt. We didn't need to see him sporting half a roll of quarters. That just seems unnecessary. It doesn't really add. I feel like it would take away a lot from the scene. Like, he's pouring his heart out, telling someone a story for the first time in his entire life. It's been integral to his personality and his character. And then we're, look at that Danish half boner. It's all that the viewer would be able to think about. So I don't know, George, that was kind of a silly thing to include in the book in the first place, but not in the show.
I mean, the guy doesn't have his good hand anymore. It's the last time he jerked off.
I'm sure it's been a while. I mean, he's been tied up for a really long time.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, blame him.
Another commentary tidbit. Brian Cogman, who is, he's been a writer for the show the entire time.
I thought we were done talking about half boners. He goes from not talking about half boners to Cogman.
I understand.
It's just someone doesn't have the notes out.
Cogman.
Cogman. Which is the worst superhero name of all time.
I'm sure that was a Mega Man villain at one point.
Villain like, the Cogs. Yeah, Mega Man 8.
So, more commentary tidbits. Brian Cogman, who has been
You get the power of Cogman, now you defeated him. What's that do? I don't know. Is there a hole in there? I don't know. Just fill it in.
Cockman's sidekick, Rance Mater.
Sticks into bicycle wheels.
Like Cog. There you go. Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Fantastic.
One time, actually, when I was a teenager, like, so I have a set of cousins, and one, I guess what special needs is how we say that, is the PC term. He's riding his bike, and my other cousin, who's our age, is like, watch this. And he just like throws like a broomstick. And it perfectly goes through the air and lands in the spokes. The most amazing thing. And my poor cousin Corey just, you know, obviously it stops the bike and he flips over and has a nasty accident. And we're all like, that's kind of fucked up. We're also like,
it's a really good throw.
You fucking just threw that from 30 feet away.
And it get this guy a javelin. He's going to bring a gold medal to the region.
My cousin Kyle did dominate track and field for the
second generation. There you go. That's how we knew Nintendo that he was power. Supposed to do that.
Yeah.
No, Nintendo power.
Poor Nintendo power, John.
Still, I mean, that required some level of athleticism.
It was
like
amazing.
The guy who could step the fastest.
Slamming your hands on the mat. That's all you
have
to do.
Yeah.
See, I never thought of that.
Kyle also did teach us how to, like, you know, just step off the mat, don't actually jump, and then get back on it. Very practical.
It's backwards.
See, John was an honorable world-class track meet performer.
You know how far you can jump when you just walk away and come back?
I never took the shortcuts in Super Mario World either. Like, that was for cheaters, too. You got to get through World 3.
You've also never thrown a broomstick through someone's bike.
True enough, yeah.
It's fucking amazing.
That was always very strictly said, you know, don't get anything stuck in the wheels of your, or in the spokes of your bike. It certainly made me curious. I never actually followed up on my curiosity. That would have been really cool to see.
Yeah, that'll fuck you up. Can confirm.
Well, I feel like I wasted my whole childhood now. I had two brothers. I could have seriously injured them.
Chucking shit in their spokes, man.
God damn it. Well, this is disappointing. So Brian Cogman on the commentary, he talks about Loris. We've talked about Loris, and again, another wasted character. He talks about how after Renly dies, he remains celibate. He joins the Kingsguard, and it just conveys how deeply they felt about each other. Whereas in the show, they change it. He's just a horn dog who doesn't even remember Renly, most likely, and he doesn't give a reason like why they changed it. They just changed it because they needed to change it. This is an instance of a bad show change, I would say. Like, we lose the half chub, thumbs up. Make Loris a worse character, thumbs down.
So yeah,
giveth taketh.
Unnecessary change.
I guess they needed a Tyrell for Cersei to supposedly marry too, because in the book it's one of his brothers, but they don't exist here.
That's fair, but like, why is he just? I mean, I don't know. It just,
I mean,
it
that's
seem
that's
like
is this an exit?
Well,
that's
one good of the few times that they actually show you the, you know, the spies of Littlefinger instead of just him. I heard about it off screen.
Yeah.
It's sacrificing character for plot, which is always a frustrating thing. You get that the show has to do it, and like Bobby, you mentioned the other Tyrell brothers. The show has to cut all these people for a good reason. The cast is already huge. I get it, but it just makes the world feel so much smaller, whereas the books, George has no problem filling out those family trees that he always includes in that.
No, and he names them all. Yeah. You'll never hear him again, but he names him at least once.
Even celibate Loris, who's going to marry Cersei, makes more sense than dude fucking around, I suppose. I don't know. Maybe not. I don't know. I'm with you. I think it's a bad change.
No, I think it is a bad change. I think the thing is, like, that's what got him out of the Kingsguard or whatever. Or he wasn't in the Kingsguard because of the whole Cersei plot. But the whole, you know, just being a horn dog never made sense. No.
Yeah, and of all the Tyrells that get, like, swooped up in that Faith of the Seven nonsense, like, he is certainly the worst served out of all of them. And we talked about this last time, that you just never get a sense of him being a badass, except for that one time he tricked the mountain in the first season. He's supposed to be, like, one of the best swordsmen in all of Westeros. And, yeah, whatever, here nor there. Last book change. All the Theon stuff is happening in the background in the book, whereas for good and ill, we actually see Ramsay fucking with him in the show. Good, again, up until the end of the fourth episode. We'll revisit in the sixth episode, and we're not going to see him again for the rest of the third season, but just like the pure torture porn of it is tiresome. And probably the worst part of the third season, which otherwise is, if not my favorite season, certainly second favorite.
Tiresome is the best way to put it.
Yeah. And it's only two scenes, I think, of Theon. Well, three. Like, the various Boltons are torturing him earlier in the first part of the season. And then Ramsay is directly, but there's only so much an actor can do with it. They're just screaming in horrible pain, and it's certainly not fun to watch or compelling in any way. You're not learning anything about either character, really.
Yeah, how much do the sausages cost to purchase? Probably a lot.
You get a good meme out of it.
I was say, it gave us that gif that will never end.
It would just have been much better to have that, not implied, but like, just all of a sudden, Ramsay is waving a sausage in Theon's face and taunting him with it. And he still mails the box to Balon, but you don't see what's in the box. You could put two and two together. Yeah. It's not explicit in the book either, but
I felt like it was excessive. They drew balls on the sausage.
I mean, this fifth episode has a whole lot of nudity, so that'll do us for this episode of our Game of Thrones Greatest Hits series. We'll be back in the next couple weeks with a discussion of 3.6, The Wall, in which they climbed the wall, and 3.9, famously the Red Wedding episode. So both of those will surely not be stomach-churning and gross in any way, shape, or form. In the meantime, you can check us out on the internet, mediacommovie.club. We are discussing The Burbs currently, but by the time this episode comes out, we'll be discussing Brawl and Cell Block 99. Haven't watched that one yet as of the recording of this episode, but it damn sure better be better than The Burbs, which was one more abomination from the 80s.
I'm looking forward to that conversation.
I'm fine that I watched it, but for fuck's sake.
I still enjoyed it. I watched it again.
Every trio.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in 20 years, and I still found it enjoyable.
That is a good two-thirds of a movie.
There's a brief window where I was like, holy shit, maybe they could pull this off. They don't. But again, we'll be talking about
they
that.
Didn't.
We'll be talking about that in a future Movie Trio podcast. You can also listen to our last Movie Trio podcast about Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri and High Noon and I Am Not a Serial Killer. We had a great discussion about that, myself, Shane, and Brian. That is also available at MediaCommovie.club as well as through iTunes, where, you know, if you leave us a review, it helps us to reach more people. You can also follow what we're doing on Facebook at Munich Movie Club, and you can follow our rarely used Twitter account at Mediocre Movie Cult. Thank you for joining me tonight, guys.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Have a good night.